Hey, you spooky good humans. Welcome back to Murdered and Missing. I'm your host, Nicole, and the story I have for you today brings us all the way up north to New Hampshire to discuss the unidentified serial killer given the moniker the Connecticut River Valley Killer. But before we get into this week's case, I do want to apologize for the late notice of no episode last week. Some of you may have seen on Instagram, but my entire household was plagued by the most vicious stomach flu that I have had since I was a small child. My oldest daughter brought it home from school. Thank you, oldest daughter. And then it proceeded to spread from my youngest, who then gave it to my husband, who then gave it to me, and then after both my husband and I and the oldest child felt better, said youngest one got it again. So she had it twice. In addition to all fun things that come with a stomach flu, we also had fevers, and now big child has a head cold. So it has been a very, very rough week and a half, 2 weeks in my house. In addition to being sick, I also had to work full-time and balance two of my master's courses, classes. It was hell on earth. Oh, man. Okay, but that's all the business that I have for you guys, so let's dive in. So the Connecticut River Valley Killer is theorized to be responsible for a series of killings in Claremont, New Hampshire, and in the Connecticut River Valley, which is where the Connecticut River Valley Killer moniker comes into play. It's theorized that he was active from the late 1970s to the 1980s. And today, I will be giving you a blanket trigger warning for this week's entire episode. And that is due to the occasional mention of sexual assault in some of the cases. And I do want to make note that before you guys come for me, some of the victims are going to have more information and details surrounding their cases. And that is because I was able to find more information on those victims. It's not because I wanted to play favorites. It's just what was available to me when I was doing my research. In contrast, some of those victims are going to have very minimal, like, a little blurb. Like I said, it is just what was available to me. And those victims are Kathy Milliken, Mary Elizabeth Critchley, Bernice Cortmanchi, Ellen Ruth Fried, Eva Marie Morse, Linda M. Moore, Barbara Agnew, and Jane Bronski. These are their stories. Starting in 1978, the bodies of seven young women would be discovered within a 50-mile radius of the Connecticut River Valley, spanning the New Hampshire and Vermont border along Route 91. The only thing known for sure about these murders is that the first piece of evidence was discovered in the 1980s. The investigation into this killer faced several roadblocks from the start. The condition of the bodies when they were found often left investigators with very little evidence or clues. The field of forensic technology was not where it is today, and this only hindered the investigation even more. There was not many witnesses that would come forward, and local investigators had rarely seen a crime of this magnitude, and they were stumped on how and where to begin because of this. And even though it's not a definitive answer of yes or no that a single killer is responsible, authorities believe it is the workings of an unidentified serial killer. And they believe this because of the location that the victims' bodies were found in and the evidence of sexual assault, where the victims lived, or where they disappeared from. The organization of this killer and the evidence of sexual assault, the specific wound patterns, and some of those eyewitness accounts that they do have are all very similar, and this is just more evidence that leads some investigators, not all, but some, to believe that this is the workings of one man. Now, there are two very important details that are going to come up time and time again in all of these women's stories. And that is a man driving a Jeep Wagoneer, and that all of these women had a caregiver role, whether they were a nurse, a nurse's aide, or a mother. They all had that big similarity in common. Kathy Milliken was just 26 years old when her life was cut short. She left her work early on October 24th, 1978, and she was headed to the Chandler Brook Wetland in New London, New Hampshire. And she was going to photograph birds, because that is what she did on her off time. She loved to be in nature, and she loved to photograph birds. However, just one day later, her body would be found on October 25th, just yards from where she was last seen. The coroner on her case determined that Kathy has sustained at least 20 stab wounds that formed a V-shape along her abdomen and her neck. In some sources, it was reported that she was stabbed upwards of 29 times. And Kathy's stab wound patterns were very similar to those of later victims. And a profiler by the name of John Philippin had mentioned that sexual assault might have been involved with Kathy's murder, but the lack of physical evidence on the body would suggest otherwise. So while this profiler did believe that there was sexual assault in Kathy's case, there wasn't any evidence to support that theory. And initially, Kathy's case wasn't connected to the killer until later on in 1986. So from 1978 to 1986, they believed that Kathy's killer was just a single incidents that had occurred. But in 1986, this task force was formed, and her case was then connected based on her age, because all of these women are very close in age, the location that her body was found, because again, all of these women are going to be found in a very similar location, her demographics, and the way her remains were treated. Now, Mary Critchley was a University of Vermont student, and she was 37 years old when she was last seen on July 25, 1981, near exit 13 of the Massachusetts Turnpike in Farmington, Massachusetts. Mary was dropped off at this exit by a friend of hers, and Mary was planning on hitchhiking back to Waterbury, Vermont, where she was living. Sadly, Mary's body would be found 2 weeks later on August 9th, 1981, in the woods off Unity Stage Road in Unity, New Hampshire. Now, this is about 80 miles from where she was last seen in Vermont. The medical examiner in Mary's case could not determine a cause of death because of the condition of Mary's body. Now, I'm assuming that the condition was decomp. You know, it's summertime, it's July, it's August, it's hot, it's muggy, it's humid, and that is going to increase decomp. And so she was found in the woods, and graphic trigger warning, I can only assume, it is not mentioned anywhere, but I'm assuming possible animal markings may have been on her body. I don't want to get too graphic with it. So I think that's why they were unable to determine a cause of death. Now, her murder has been linked to the serial killer because, again, her age, where she was found, and the condition her body was found in. It is believed, though, that Mary was stabbed to death. They're not entirely sure, but it is theorized. Now, our third victim is Heidi Martin. Now, Heidi was last seen jogging on Martinsville Road in Hartland, Vermont on May 20th, 1984. She was tragically found one day later in a swampy area behind the Hartland Elementary School. And it has not been confirmed that she was a victim of the killer in question, but she is associated with this killer because the location of her body and her autopsy showed multiple stab wounds to her chest and her heart. Now, she is not linked to the serial killer because she only had stab wounds to the heart and chest, and she was lacking that telltale V pattern and those stab wounds to the neck. So she is associated and they're thinking that she was a victim of this murder, but they're not sure. So again, very similar to the other victims, but Heidi's autopsy also revealed that she had drowned. So again, this is different than the rest of the victims. So during her autopsy, the medical examiner found dirt, silt, and water in her throat and lungs. So this means that she had her head placed under a body of water and inhaled the dirt and the silt and water while she was still alive. And it's unclear what her exact cause of death was. They were unable to determine if it was the stab wounds or the drowning that was Heidi's cause of death. Now, another outlier in Heidi's case is that she would have been the youngest victim because she was only 16 years old. So she doesn't fit the exact victim pattern as we see in the other victims with the age and being a caregiver. So I did want to put Heidi's story in here because her murder is still unsolved and there is some evidence to suggest that she may be linked to this killer, but it's not 100% that she is linked. Now, after Heidi is found, we're actually going to see our first suspect. So this suspect's name is Delbert Tallman. And in 1984, during the investigation into Heidi's murder, Delbert actually confessed to killing Heidi and then retracted his confession, claiming that it was a different man who had killed her. And despite Delbert living in multiple locations near where the other bodies were discovered, it remains unclear whether Delbert is associated with the other killings. Now, in 1978, when Kathy was killed, Delbert would have only been 16 years old, and in 1984, he would have been only 22, and that is when Heidi was killed. Now, Delbert was actually arrested and tried for the murder of Heidi, but he was found not guilty. And he was also found not guilty of other charges in 1986. In an interview with Libby Farrow, April Stone, who is Heidi's sister, said Delbert was living near the road that Heidi had jogged on very often and had even admitted that he had been in the woods that day that she was attacked. And Delbert told authorities that he actually hid behind a tree and waited for, quote, the bad man to leave, and then ran over to Heidi to check on her. Now, at this point, he's going to discover that she's not alive and he's going to run out of the woods. Now, I want to make it known that Delbert is on the autism spectrum and has a lower IQ. So this is why I believe he was easily manipulated into making a false confession. And using verbiage like the bad man and hiding and, you know, wanting to avoid contact with police are all very indicative of individuals with autism spectrum disorder. They don't want to make eye contact with individuals. They often will use simple terms like bad man and are very easily steered towards getting them to say what you want them to say, which is what I think happened here. Authorities saw this guy and was like, "Nah, he's good for it," and they got him to confess. And I think the jury saw right through that and realized that this guy was not guilty. Is Delbert guilty of other crimes and is he been convicted of other crimes? Yes, but Delbert is not on trial in our podcast today. So we are not going to get into those. But in the same interview with Libby Farrow, April Stone told Libby, quote, "There was no way anyone would have walked away from killing my sister without having some bruising or being scratched, without being soaking wet, bloody, and muddy. Delbert Tallman walked out of those woods and hitchhiked, and the only thing he had was mud on his shoes," end quote. April doesn't believe that Delbert is responsible for her sister's murder, and neither do I. It doesn't fit. So I did want to make that note, you know, because he does come up in my investigation, but he was tried and he was found not guilty. He was acquitted. I don't think he is good for any of these crimes. Moreover, I don't think he was good for Heidi's murder. He has been convicted, and I believe he is out on parole currently for other crimes, but none of them are for murder or attempted murder. So, seventeen-year-old Bernice Courtmunch left her home in West Claremont, New Hampshire around 3:30 p.m. on May 30th, 1984. And Bernice was headed to her boyfriend's house, and it's believed that she was, again, here's that hitchhiking connection, along Route 12, there's another connection, just like Mary Critchley. So she was trying to hitchhike from West Claremont, New Hampshire to Newport, New Hampshire, which is where her boyfriend lived. And this would be the last confirmed sighting of her alive. And it would be only 10 days after Heidi was murdered that Bernice went missing. And Bernice's decomposed body would be found 2 years later by a fisherman on April 19th, 1986. She was found near the Sugar River in Newport, New Hampshire. An autopsy report stated her cause of death was multiple stab wounds, a head injury, and her throat was slit. Due to the location of her body, she is believed to be one of the victims as well. Now, one thing I want to note in Bernice's case, we don't see the telltale V shape of the stab wounds. Now, I'm not sure if that's just because it wasn't reported in her case or I just wasn't able to find it, but she does have the stab wounds to her neck, so there is a similarity there. Now, the only thing that is different is Bernice has a head wound. None of the other victims had a head wound, so I don't know, but she has been linked to being one of the victims as well. Now, she is 17 years old, and that makes her just 1 year older than Heidi. And again, she would be on the younger side of the victim profile. So that's not a reason to negate Bernice as one of the victims. It is just something that I wanted to note because I want to make sure that you guys have all of the information possible to form your own decisions based on the story and what we're going to talk about at the very end. Now, 26-year-old Ellen Ruth Freeds was Bernice's nurse's aide, and she was last seen alive on July 22nd, 1984. And she was actually talking on a payphone with her sister outside a convenience store. Now, remember the convenience store, just tuck that away in like your brain back pocket because a convenience store is going to come up again. Now, while on the phone, she noticed a strange car circling the parking lot. Now, I searched high and low and I was unable to find if the strange car was a Jeep Wagoneer or not. It was just strange car. And so while she was on the phone, she does mention this to her sister, and she actually put her sister on hold for a minute, and then she walked to her car, started it, and then returned back to the payphone to finish the conversation. And sometime between finishing the conversation with her sister and heading home, Ellen went missing. Her car would be found abandoned on Jarvis Road, very close to where that payphone was, where she was last seen. And as I mentioned earlier, Ellen and Bernice had a direct connection. And this is the first time that we're going to actually see a connection of this magnitude between victims. And this is the first time that the police are actually going to link the victims together, and they're gonna say, okay, maybe we have a serial killer amongst us. And 2 months before Ellen disappeared is when Bernice disappeared, so they were within 2 months of each other that they disappeared, and it took them or excuse me, it took them 2 years to find Bernice, and it would be 18 months that it would take them to find Ellen. So on September 19th, Ellen's remains were found, and on April 19th, 1986, Bernice's remains were found. So I don't know, man. So like July, she goes missing, right? And that's 2 months after Bernice went missing. Because Bernice, you know, she went missing May 30th, 1984. Ellen went missing on July 22nd, 1984. Bernice is found April 19th, 1986. Ellen's found September 19th, 1986. Listen, do I have any, like, NCIS fans here? Because it's never a coincidence, right? It's never a coincidence. Gibbs doesn't believe in them. I'm kind of starting to think that this fictional character may be onto something. I don't know. Let's continue. So, our next victim is 36-year-old stay-at-home mom of two, Linda Moore. And her murder is what causes the investigation to take a turn. And that's because her murder is going to be the first time that we actually get a composite sketch of the attacker. Yes, that's right. Her murder is when we get our first composite sketch. So this guy was so methodical, so organized, and so well planned out that he was able to avoid being seen, was able to avoid leaving any fingerprints, any DNA, anything that could potentially identify him, including witnesses. That it's now 1986. His first victim was in 1978, and this is the first time we're getting a composite sketch. And we get this composite sketch because Linda was seen in the late morning hours and early afternoon hours around town and then out back of her house sunbathing and listening to her radio. And some witnesses that came forward in Linda's case also claimed that they had seen several people around her house, but one individual in particular stuck out to them. And this man was seen wearing a cheap pair of sunglasses, had dark colored hair, and was carrying a blue backpack. Now, Vermont State Police Major Crimes Unit Detective Sergeant Frank Lombard told News 10, quote, "The assault had occurred and the assailant had left right after. There was no sign of forced entry, nothing was ransacked, and nothing was taken," end quote. So this individual knew exactly what they wanted inside that house, and that was Linda's life. Now, John Philippin is an investigator on Linda's case, and he's also the profiler that I mentioned earlier, Kathy Milliken's story. And he theorized that the killer was either startled or interrupted during the murder, and that's why her body wasn't moved. So his theory was that he had gone in, he murdered Linda, and was planning on taking her body to another location and dumping her. But again, that's just a theory and we're not sure. Now, when Linda was found, it was evident by the gruesome crime scene and the defensive wounds on her arms and hands that she fought, and she fought hard. Unfortunately, she lost that fight. The stab wounds to her neck were just too much for her. Again, there's those neck stab wounds. Now, investigators also noted that Linda's murder was actually similar to Bernice and Eva's murder in that their stab wounds, their stab wound patterns were similar. And I know you're probably wondering who Eva is, but we're going to get to her too. Now, the biggest difference between Linda's case and the other cases is that we've got witnesses that could describe the assailant. Linda's body was not found in a remote location, but was actually found in her home. And we've got this composite sketch. But we don't have any physical evidence. We don't have any DNA, and we don't have any fingerprints. But, Like I said, thanks to those witnesses, we get our first composite sketch of the killer. Now, we don't know if it's the killer of all the other women or if it's just Linda's killer. I theorize it is one singular killer and not multiple killers operating in New England at the same time. ...27-year-old Eva Morse had been described as having a difficult start in life, but she was doing her hardest to turn things around. And from my research, she was doing just that. She was a single mother, and her daughter had just celebrated her 10th birthday a few days before Eva went missing. Eva was last seen on the morning of July 10th, 1985, hitchhiking on Route 12 in North Charleston. She was found on April 25th, 1986, in West Unity. And according to the ME on her case, she was stabbed to death. Now, while her case has been linked to the other killings in the Connecticut River Valley, cold case officials have stated that they don't believe that the cases are connected. So they don't believe that Eva's case is connected to these other Connecticut River Valley killings. But some investigators do believe that they are connected. And I believe that they are connected as well. And here's why. Eva was hitchhiking on Route 12, just like Mary and just like Bernice. And in addition to her hitchhiking on Route 12, she was stabbed to death. She was found in West Unity, and she was found 500 feet from where Mary's body was discovered. And that is just way too much of a connection or a coincidence, whatever word you want to use, to ignore. When Eva was found, her body was so badly decomposed though, so it was hard to tell if there was a stab pattern, but there was evidence to suggest that there were stab wounds to her neck, just like Linda and Bernice. And finally, one of the sources for today's episode also notes that Eva and another victim, Eileen, that we are going to talk about, looked similar, and they were both single mothers. And I did find a photo of Eva and her daughter, along with Eileen and her daughter, and I can't deny it, there are some similar facial structures. Now, I know you're probably wondering who Eileen is and why I bring her up. She's going to be important later on in the story when I discuss potential suspects and who I think is the person who committed these crimes. Now, 39-year-old Barbara Agnew was a divorced registered nurse with a 7-year-old son. So again, we've got that single mother connection. We've got that caregiver. Not only is she a nurse, but she's also a mom. And on January 10th, 1987, Barbara was on her way home in a blizzard when she decided to pull over at a rest stop on Interstate 91. She was only 10 miles from home. And at this rest stop, her car would be discovered abandoned with a door ajar and evidence in and around, I'm not sure, but there was evidence to support foul play. And according to the Vermont State Police, her car was towed just a few days after it was found. And on January 14th, Barbara's late ex-husband reported her missing. And according to reporting by Libby Farrow, once again, Detective Sergeant Tyson Kinney of the Vermont State Police Major Crimes Unit told Libby, quote, "The towing company attempted to get a hold of her to find out what was going on with her vehicle, and they contacted him, and that's when the report was made that she was missing." Now, a few days after Barbara was reported missing, an attendant at that rest stop where she went missing from found some clothes tossed in a dumpster, and inside those clothes was Barbara's ID. So they also found some other objects in that dumpster that were also identified as more of Barbara's possessions. And initially, the investigation was focusing mainly on that rest stop where her car was found. But on March 28th, 1987, so a few months later, hikers who were walking along Advent Hill Road in Heartland found a pile of clothes, or what they thought was clothes, but it was actually Barbara. And Barbara's body had the same stab wounds, same stab patterns as several of the other victims, and her body was found only a mile away from where Heidi's body was found 3 years earlier. But in Barbara's case, it's the first time we're actually going to get fingerprints. So now we got another first. First, we had a composite sketch in Linda's case, and now we've got fingerprints in Barbara's case. Unfortunately, though, those fingerprints have not been linked to anyone just yet. Investigators are still working to find a connection and find out who these fingerprints belong to, but as it stands, 2022, they do not have any persons of interest or suspect to link those fingerprints to. Now, the final victim that I want to talk about that has been 100% connected to the Connecticut River Valley. She is not the final victim in the story, but the final victim in connection to the Connecticut River Valley killer. And this is 22-year-old Jane Borowski. I hope I'm saying that right. On August 6, 1988, Jane was 7 months pregnant and was on her way home from a fair when she pulled into the parking lot of a closed convenience store. But there was a vending machine, that was out front of the store where Jane would get a soda from. And I have all of this information because Jane survives. And Jane does an interview with the podcast Murder, She Told. And she told them, quote, "I pulled in, went to the vending machine, got my soda, and I noticed this vehicle pull in and park right next to me on my passenger side," end quote. So again, we're seeing that vehicle approach somebody who is in an isolated area, who is alone, who is a woman, and ends up attacking her, right? So we've seen it in Ellen's case. She was outside of her car on the phone with her sister, and we also see it in Barbara's case. She was at a rest stop in her car and she was alone. So I don't know. It's just very, very suspicious. Now, the car that pulled in was a Jeep Wagoneer, and the man driving that Jeep got out, walked around the back side of her car, again, kind of weird, and walks up on her side where she had her window down. And he asked Jane if the payphone was working. And after asking her this question, he ends up opening her car door and tries to get her out of the car. And Jane said that when he tried getting her out of the car, she began to scream. And she said that she was screaming so hard that she actually broke blood vessels in her eyes. And after getting out of the car, going back and forth with who this guy was, what he wanted, you know, because at this point, Jane's worried that this guy is a nutcase because of some of the things that he's saying to her. Like, one of the things was that Jane beat up his girlfriend, and Jane, you know, told that podcast Murder, She Told that she didn't beat up his girlfriend, that she didn't even know who his girlfriend was or who he was. And then the guy goes on to ask her if it is a Massachusetts car because he's got a New Hampshire car. I don't know. It was just really weird stuff. Almost like this guy was unhinged or trying to throw her off, which to me, it seems like he is trying to distract her and disorient her by asking her these like really strange questions. So Jane does say that at this point in time, she did not feel threatened. I don't know if, you know, at one point she was feeling threatened because he pulled her out of the car, which I can only assume, you know, those are valid feelings and that's what was happening. But as the situation began to de-escalate, those feelings of being threatened kind of wore off, and, you know, I don't know, but That's soon going to change because this man is going to pull out a knife and he's going to stick it against her throat. And Jane said that's when she knew she was in danger. And most of the source material for Jane's account actually does come from the podcast Murder, She Told, and some other source material, but a majority of it does include that interview with Jane, and it was just too good to pass up. So, you know, I did use that as source material, and I do want to make note that it was Murder, She Told. I am also going to link that episode in the show notes, so if you guys would like to listen to it, it's a really good episode, and you guys should. So while Jane was outside of the car talking to this unknown assailant, he pulls the knife, like I said, and he sticks it against her throat. And Jane said that this is when all of the fear would come rushing back. And at that moment, as all the fear came rushing back into Jane, she saw a car driving down the road and she felt hopeful. And so she took off running and she tried desperately to get the driver's attention. Unfortunately, the car didn't see her or just didn't want to stop, and it kept moving. And the next thing Jane knew, she was being tackled to the ground. After she was tackled, Jane was then stabbed 27 times and left for dead. Somehow, Jane was still alive, and she stood up and she walked back to her car and then proceeded to drive herself to her friend's house who lived nearby. But we're not done with the jaw-dropping information just yet. As Jane drove to her friend's house, she drove behind the frickin' attacker the entire way. I don't even know. So once Jane got to her friend's house and pulled into the driveway, she got out and then she collapsed on the lawn. And after she collapsed and lay bleeding on the lawn, she watched as the Jeep made a U-turn and then drive by her again and stare at her so intently, which just typing that and reading that out loud sent shivers down my spine. Now this Jeep does drive off once that Jane's friend comes rushing out of her house, and she loads her up into her car and she gets to the hospital. And Jane would go on to tell the podcast Murder, She Told that she had a severed jugular, 2 collapsed lungs. I'm sorry, how are you breathing at that point, ma'am? Are you superhuman? Because I feel like you are. A lacerated liver, and she also ended up losing a portion of her liver. A tendon in her hand was severed from trying to fight him off, and then a tendon in her knee was also severed in the attack. Now, miraculously, her baby survived and suffered no stab wounds, no injuries, and Jane said that she is perfectly fine. Holy cow. Holy cow, y'all. I was floored reading that information. Now, let's get into the other two suspects that we have in this case. The first suspect is Gary Westover, a Grafton, New Hampshire resident, and he gave a deathbed confession in which he told retired Grafton County Sheriff's Deputy Howard Minnan that he had witnessed a murder of whom he believed was Barbara Agnew. And Westover, who was a paraplegic, had confessed to Howard that he and 3 friends went out drinking one night. And those 3 friends show up to Gary's house and they load him in his wheelchair into their van and they go out. And not thinking anything about it, Westover went along with it because, you know, nothing seems amok. That is until his friends allegedly decided to abduct a woman and murder her. And I say allegedly because we don't know. Okay? We don't know if there's any weight behind this confession. Now, according to Westover, they did leave her in a remote location, but they didn't specify this location. And in 1997, Westover's uncle, Howard, that's right, retired Grafton County Sheriff's Deputy Howard, that's Westover's uncle, reported this to the authorities, but no action was taken. I'm sorry, what? Is that the sound of a police cover-up? That sounds like that. Anyway, moving on. So this leads me to believe that maybe they didn't believe his story. I don't know, from what I read, maybe they're treating it like a false confession and they believe that Westover wanted attention, or was he actually there and witnessed the crime and the authorities dropped the ball by not pursuing this tip further? I don't know, possibly, because a year after this confession, Westover passed away, and then dear old Uncle Howard died in 2006. But shortly after dear old Uncle Howard died, and 10 years after Westover's original confession, one of Westover's aunts wrote to Barbara's sister. And at first I was like, man, why would she reach out to the victim's family? Like, why would she take it upon herself to do this? Why would she rip open an old wound? But then, you know, like, I kind of took myself out of the equation and I was trying to think unbiasedly and more from like an outside perspective. And I think she wrote to her sister because this aunt truly believed that Gary was there and that he knew who committed these murders. And if this is true, good on her. But I have so many questions about why Gary and his band of criminal friends are not investigated further. Now, we're going to talk about our last suspect, and that's Michael Andrew Nicolau. I don't know. I don't really care either. But Barbara's sister actually sent the information that she received from Westover's aunt to an investigator who was working on a missing persons case in Holyoke, Massachusetts. Now, this missing persons case possibly has a connection with the alleged serial killer that they're currently hunting, right? So this alleged killer is Michael Andrew Nicolau. I don't really care. Like I said, no, he's a native of Long Island, New York. And he was described as having a rough childhood. And in high school, he was into wrestling and was also a black belt in karate. Now, one of the sources that I read for this week's case said that he had, quote, an affinity for violence, end quote, because he was into karate and wrestling. I'm sorry, but that does not mean that you have an affinity for violence. That statement just floored me. As somebody who studies psychology, neither one of those two things correlate to an affinity for violence. I'm sorry, but that, no. Anyway, moving on. So Michael enlisted in the Army after high school, and he served as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam. And while enlisted, he received 2 Purple Hearts, 2 Silver Stars, and 2 Bronze Stars, which, I mean, that right there means that he was a good soldier, right? Well, he was a good soldier. He ended up being discharged from active duty for flying his helicopter too low and murdering civilians in the Mekong Delta with bombs and machine guns. Now, this, ladies and gentlemen, is what I would describe as an affinity for violence. That is an affinity for violence. Not liking wrestling and karate. No. However, the charges were dropped and he was treated for PTSD. Now, you're probably wondering, how is Michael and how is Gary relevant since none of the victims were discussed, right? Well, we're going to get into that. So, Michael married 20-year-old Holyoke native Michelle Ashley. The two married in Charlottesville, Virginia, and then they moved back to Holyoke, roughly 90 miles away from Claremont, the same Claremont where all of these murders occurred. Now, Michelle frequently expressed concerns to her family and how she felt scared for her life and how she wanted to leave Michael. And she planned on leaving him after her sister's wedding in 1988. In December of 1988, shortly after her sister's wedding, Michelle went missing. And when questioned by investigators, her husband, Michael, denied ever knowing her. What? I'm sorry, what? Like, he admits to having, quote, a relationship with her, end quote. Sir, I have questions. You were married and y'all had children together. That's a little bit more than a relationship. I am heated about that. Later, Michael is quoted as calling her a slut. Not gonna lie, I'm writing that, editing that, and then saying that. I think I rolled my eyes so hard, I have a pretty good idea of what my brain looks like. Like, I hate being on camera and I hate being on like a video, but right now I wish that I was so y'all could see my face. I don't even know. Later in the investigation, Michael is going to claim that Michelle ran off with a Colombian drug dealer, leaving her children in his care to be neglected so terribly that later on, when they were older and became adults, they would give a tearful interview about the neglect that they suffered at his hands. I'm sorry, sir. I call BS. I call horse doo-doo. I call cow manure. That did not happen, sir. You made her disappear. Okay? Okay. Now that we've got that cleared up. He also abandoned their shared apartment, and then he bounced around after Michelle disappeared. Like, get bent, dude. Seriously, get bent. I hope karma has fun with you. Karma does. I'm trying not to say what happens. But I hope wherever he is now, he is kicking metal chairs with his pinky toe repeatedly. So now we're going to fast forward to 2001, and Michael's going to be living in Lutz, Florida, where he's going to meet Eileen Bowman, the same Eileen that I had mentioned previously. And the pair would marry in Vegas. Eileen and her daughter, Taryn, whom she had from a previous relationship, Michael, and Michael's children, and some sources say their children, so I'm not sure if Eileen and Michael had children together or if it was Michael's children from his relationship in marriage with Michelle and Eileen's daughter, but they're all going to move in together, and they're going to move from Florida to Georgia, then they're going to move back to Florida, back to Georgia, and then they're going to bounce around throughout both of those states. But like Michelle, Eileen is going to have similar issues with Michael, and Michael even demanded that his freaking son, y'all, run Eileen over with the family Jeep, which was the Jeep Wagoneer, while he held her at gunpoint. The trauma that those children must have experienced at the hands of this monster is sickening, and I can only imagine the PTSD and I'm stuttering because I can't even formulate like actual like sentences that are PG enough to describe this monster of a human being and what he did to those children. After this incident, though, Eileen is going to go into hiding, and she's going to remain hidden from Michael for the next 4 years. They met in 2001, and by 2005, she went into hiding. 4 years. I can't imagine the torture that she suffered in those 4 years. But in 2005, Michael finds her. And what happens next is heartbreaking. So he figures out that Eileen is at her sister Aubrey's house. And he shows up to Aubrey's house in a trench coat, which concealed two guns. And Michael then holds Taryn hostage inside of Aubrey's house for 3 hours. And during those hours, Aubrey did call the authorities, and she waited painfully for the SWAT to arrive. However, it would be too late, because Michael would shoot and kill Taryn and Eileen and then turn the gun on himself. I don't feel bad for him. I hope you rot. And like I said earlier, I hope wherever you are, you kick your pinky toe repeatedly on a metal chair. Okay. All right. Moving on. Michelle's parents, his first wife, hired a private investigator by the name of Lynn Marie Carty to find out where Michelle was. And she was particularly interested in connecting Michelle's disappearance to the other New England killings. There was nothing definitive, and no connection has been made between Michelle and the other murders. But authorities do note some similarities that you may say, too. The first similarity is Michelle's parents knew Gary Westover's parents. The same Gary Westover whose aunt contacted Barbara Agnew's aunt, or sister, excuse me, about the confession that Gary gave on his deathbed. And Carty got this information and then contacted Westover's aunt, who allegedly said that Michelle's name sounded familiar. And there is also an alleged connection between Gary and Michael, as they potentially could have met at a VA hospital undergoing PTSD treatments. But since Gary has passed away, this connection was never firmly established. Now, Jane Borowski has also said that there is some resemblance between Michael and the guy who attacked her. So we know that Michael's responsible for Michelle's disappearance. Do we have physical evidence? No. But we know, right? We know. Everybody else knows that we know. And we know that Eileen had a similar story to Eva, because they're both single mothers. They both disappear. And just more, there are more similarities that are linking these women, and they're all kind of centering around Westover and around Michael. Now, when McCarty was reviewing Jane's testimony, she noticed that Jane said her attacker used a martial arts grip on her. And if you remember, Michael was a black belt in karate. So there's that. And then in a baby book that Michelle was jotting down information throughout her pregnancy back in 1986, she noted that she was in the same hospital that Barbara Agnew worked at during Thanksgiving of 86. And Barbara was then found in January of 87. Barbara was also found just a few miles away from where Michelle and the rest of the family had spent Christmas. Now, Jane also described a Jeep Wagoneer in her attack, and Michelle's family described a very similar Jeep that same year. Now, the biggest similarity of all of them is the caregiver role that these women had. Like I mentioned earlier, Michelle was already a mother when she met Michael. Michael's mom was a nurse, and Michelle was not Michael's first wife. She was actually his second wife because his first wife was also a nurse. And Mary was in school for nursing. Bernice had a nurse's aide. Ellen was the nurse's aide. Barbara was a nurse. Eva was a mother. Lynn was a mother. There are just so many striking similarities. Eileen was a mother, and Eileen and Eva look similar to each other. There's just a lot of things going on here. And there's one last thing that I want to note. So remember how I said that Michael and Michelle met in Virginia? Well, Michael was connected posthumously as being the potential Blue Ridge Parkway rapist, among other. Now, like I said, Michelle and Michael met in Virginia, and the Blue Ridge Parkway is in Virginia, but these murders occurred in New England, so how are they all connected? Well, allegedly, Michael was running drugs from Virginia to New England, and he also met Michelle in Virginia, and then this also connects back to Gary, because allegedly, Gary was selling drugs on the side to offset his disability pay. So, could it be that Michael was running drugs to Gary and met Michelle on one of these drug runs, and this is where all that connection comes in, and that's how Michelle gets to Virginia, back to New England? I don't know. But Steve Rolland is the investigator on this case and has been since, from what I've seen, almost the beginning. And he stated that he never heard of Michael or any of these details until the murder-suicide back in 2005. So I don't know if it's because the states and the separate police departments aren't communicating, and that's why these details aren't circulating, and that's why we don't have all of the information. I don't know. But in 2018, Rolland told the Rutland Herald that DNA testing has been delayed due to the backlog of cases at the lab. And as it stands currently in 2022, this case remains unsolved. So I don't know what other DNA besides the fingerprints that has been collected, and I am going to post the composite sketches of the attacker, and then I'm going to post some photos of Michael next to the composite sketches. I'm also going to be including some photos of Eileen and Eva, just to see some of those similarities. But if you ask me, I think Michael is an excellent suspect. And I think Westover was telling the truth. I think that Michael is the killer. And I know some of you are like, well, he shot and killed his wife and stepdaughter. You know, how is that the same? Well, I think the shooting and killing of Eileen and Taryn was the heat of the moment, you know? So we've got these two separate methodologies. We've got the stabbings and then we have the shootings. So I think what happened was Michael was pissed that Eileen left and he no longer could exert control over her. I think that he was narcissistic and was losing control, and found Eileen and found Taryn and took it into his own hands to, you know, regain some semblance of control over them. And in narcissistic personality disorders, they are very selfish and they like to control things. And I think that the shooting of Eileen and Taryn was a crime of passion, and I think that he is responsible for these stabbings of these other women. And even though, you know, the killer who took the women in New England seemed to be very organized and methodical, in, you know, Michael's killing of Eileen and Taryn was not organized and it was not methodical, I still think he's good for it. You know, I think that Michael is responsible for all of the killings in the Connecticut River Valley. I know that he is responsible for killing Eileen and Taryn. I know that he's responsible for Michelle's disappearance and most likely Michelle's death, because they still don't know where she is. But what do you guys think? After hearing all the facts around this case, what do y'all think? Let's discuss. Let's meet up in the Facebook group and let's talk about it, because this case is crazy. But that is all that I have for you guys this week. I hope you guys come back next week, because we're going to be talking about another unsolved case. And next week is probably going to be just as big of a doozy as this one was. And, you know, I would love if you guys send me suggestions. You can send those suggestions to me in an email at murderedandmissing416@gmail.com. You can DM me on Instagram, murderedandmissingpod. Or like I said earlier, you can join me in the Facebook discussion group. But that's it. That's all I got. Stay spooky. Be a good human, y'all. P.S. Don't be like Michael.